Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shops, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. It's the beginning of a new dawn, a new era, perhaps, as MPs from across the country head to Parliament for the first week of Tory majority government in quite some time. Boris Johnson has a majority of 80. We've seen pictures and snaps of Tory MPs recently elected from the once red wall, we might now begin to call it blue, heading down to take their seats. James, what do we have in store in terms of what's going to happen in Parliament this week? Today, it seems that MPs are mainly just getting their inductions.
Yeah, so what we will see is all of these new MPs arriving. I was walking past the lockers set up for the new MPs, and it's quite telling. There are about three big banks of lockers for the Conservative MPs, and there's a very small sign saying new Labour MPs and a very small set of lockers, which I think tells you what you need to know. And I think that one of the things with the Tories is they are sending MPs to Westminster from constituencies that have never elected a Tory MP before. There are regional concentrations of Tories, you know, self-reinforcing. I think if you think about it, one of the things that was so effective about the Tory victory in the South West against the Liberal Democrats in 2015 was for the whole region turned blue, meaning that which has made it easier for them to hold on to those seats. Similar things have happened in the Tees Valley, North Wales and other bits of the so-called Red Wall. So on Thursday, we will get the Queen's Speech, which will set out the government's agenda. And this will be unlike almost any Queen's Speech we've had since 2010, in that we will know that every single bill in that Queen's Speech is going to pass because he has a majority. It will be very predictable. We won't be looking for the thing on which, you know, and it won't matter if two Tory MPs say that they object to this bill or that bill because he has a majority of 80. And then I think the big question is on Friday, whether they get this vote on the second reading of Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. They want to have that vote on Friday so that they can say to the country, Brexit is getting done, enjoy Christmas. There is uncertainty, though, about whether the opposition parties will allow it or whether they'll try and keep everyone back until Monday so the vote can't take place until December 23rd. I have to say, on behalf of the Westminster bubble, I sincerely hope that the opposition parties look at the writing on the wall and accept that the result of the second reading vote isn't going to be different, whether it's held on Friday or Monday, and let us all get on with our Christmas shopping, which we have all neglected. You know, we need to kind of kickstart Britain's high street spending.
Isabel, over the weekend, we had Boris Johnson visiting Sedgefield, one of the areas where his party won a formerly Tony Blair seat, and at points even using Tony Blair's language. It seems from all the signs so far, both privately and on the record from this government, that the big focus here is going to be trying to keep hold of these one-time Labour heartlands and, if anything, trying to make them Tory heartlands.
Yeah, so when he was in Sedgefield, he said that the Conservative government was going to repay the trust that voters had put in him and his party. And that's something that we've seen again repeated in quotes from Number 10 over the weekend about the importance of delivering for the voters who went Tory for the first time. And the Conservatives are very aware that this trust is not settled, that it's something that they're going to have to keep earning over the next few years. And regardless of the state that Labour is in, they can't take that support for granted. And so we will see a lot of announcements, particularly a lot of infrastructure spending in these constituencies. James explained at the weekend that these constituencies also need to feel as though they're improving. And actually, infrastructure projects don't tend to be the way to achieve that because they take a long time. You need to see measures, particularly for high streets, as James said, because if you spend any time in towns, well, outside London, but particularly the further you get away from London in the northwest and the northeast, the high streets are very depressed. They're full of charity shops or empty units. And that's something that voters take as the sort of the soul of their town. And they'll say, you know, the town's on the decline, even if the local economy itself is booming because of industry that's still thriving. I live in Barrow Furness, and you talk to people and they say, you know, there's nothing in the town centre, even though because of the shipyard, the local economy there is actually pretty strong. But people do see their town's identity, and identity has been a very important part of this election, as crumbling because they don't really know where the centre of their town is anymore. The town centre is often quite empty and soulless. And so that's the sort of thing that the Conservatives need to think about as well as rail links, because there's nothing that annoys commuters in the north, and you know, the north can be described as a sort of homogenous blob unfairly a lot of the time by commentators, but transport in the north is terrible. Transport across the north, getting from northwest to northeast to Yorkshire and Humberside, is terrible as well. And this has really wound voters up in the north, because for the past 9 years, the Conservatives have been talking about something called the Northern Powerhouse, and then they get on these terrible trains if they're running at all. Those are the sorts of things that the Conservatives are going to have to really focus on over the next few years.
Yes, James, we're expecting a push on infrastructure. The other thing that's been in the news this weekend has been the idea of rewiring government and transforming Whitehall. Lots are pointing to the blogs of Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's senior aide. How drastic do you think the Whitehall shake-up is going to be?
I think it is going to be more dramatic than anyone expected. I don't think this government is going to fail for any lack of radicalism in terms of its desire to reform how Whitehall works. And I think there is a particular logic to it. First of all, I think the civil service has not been good at delivery for quite a long time. Add in the fact that all of these powers are returning to the UK from the EU. And there is a clear case for restructuring Whitehall and making it work better in terms of delivery. I mean, that is the key point. And I think we will see kind of new departments and all this. And also, I think you're going to see, if you are going to do what they are going to do, if you look at the Tory manifesto, it is quite clear how they envisage kind of kick-starting the economy. You know, there's going to be lots of state spending on research and development, and the hope that that kind of then leads to kind of private sector spin-offs. You know, I think if you were looking for an example of where this has been done successfully somewhere in the world, I think Israel is quite a good example of that, and the creation of the high-tech sector there. And I think that is going to require a different approach in Whitehall, a different skill set. And it's also going to have to require doing something, you know, we were talking about Tony Blair earlier, but Tony Blair tried to do and didn't really manage to do, which is, how do you get outside expertise into the civil service? It is a very closed system, and it doesn't take well to incomers. And I think you are going to have to change that if you are going to get the British state to do the things that the Tories need it to do, if they are to get growth going in these bits of a country, which is so essential to keeping their new electoral coalition together.
Yeah, Tony Blair talked about the scars on his back from his attempts to reform Whitehall, and the Conservatives in the coalition did make a little bit of progress, did make some attempt to reform the civil service, but they obviously didn't go anywhere near as far as Dominic Cummings and those around him would have hoped, or even those who were trying to instigate those reforms back in the coalition years. And so we see in Dominic Cummings someone who has already had a much smaller clash with the civil service when he was in the education department, who knows how resistant to reform, how resistant to new policies civil servants can be, and who knows how to put it frankly, how to fight them as well.
Now, we've seen photos and tweets of excited Tory MPs heading back to Parliament, but for one party is, I suppose, a much less bright picture, and that is the Labour Party. Ultimately, they are returning with fewer MPs, and a battle is underway for the future leader and potentially the soul of the Labour Party. Isabel, what's the latest in terms of timings? We know that Jeremy Corbyn has said that he will not lead the party into the next election.
Yes, so there's a meeting today of the NEC officers to agree the date for the next National Executive Committee meeting, which will sign off this timetable for the contest. And the proposal set out by General Secretary Jenny Formby is for the contest to start on the 7th of January and to conclude in March, which, you know, there obviously is a mix of views in the Labour Party as to what sort of timetable would work best. Some want a much longer timetable so that there's a proper review of why the party lost, and then the membership can make an informed decision on that basis. Others think that if you don't move quickly enough, then you'll end up with, you know, another sort of Corbyn without a beard, as I think it was Caroline Flint put it yesterday. And so there's a sort of mix of views over which timetable will work. And talking to the moderate MPs over the weekend, who, let's face it, have not managed to win any battles or arguments since 2015, despite making dire threats about sort of red lines and things that they're planning to do next, they are also divided over what a timetable would look like. And their only real conclusion is that the last leadership contest didn't work very well for them because they thought that members would be in the same place as them, having come from the doorstep, hearing what voters said and thinking we need a change of direction in the Labour Party. It turned out that Labour members were actually in a sort of more of a kind of bereaved state, that state of denial and angry blame where you sort of lash out at anyone who's nearby. And they thought that what voters wanted was for the Labour Party to move much further to the left, and obviously elected the man who people initially thought was the joke candidate, Jeremy Corbyn. And so the only thing that moderates seem to have learned is not to make the mistake of the last leadership contest, but they don't know what the right route is for this leadership contest, which doesn't bode well for them.
Now, unless things have changed since we started recording this podcast, James, as far as I can make out, we haven't had any candidates say they are definitely running. No. We've had people who won't rule it out. So Lisa Nandy could be running.
Lisa Nandy went on the Mar programme to not rule it out, which I think is quite a good sign that she is running. I think right now it looks pretty clear that Lisa Nandy is running. It looks pretty clear that Jess Phillips is running. It looks pretty clear that Rebecca Long-Bailey will run. And then I think we can expect Keir Starmer to run. I think Emily Thornberry's chances of running have probably been torpedoed by Caroline Flint, alleging that Emily Thornberry said that she was glad that her constituents weren't as stupid as those of a Labour MP whose constituency had voted to leave. We should obviously stress for any lawyers listening that Emily Thornberry denies that charge. But I think in that you see a kind of a battlefield developing. Rebecca Long-Bailey is obviously the closest to a kind of continuity Corbyn-McDonnell candidate. She is Corbynism without the baggage, essentially. Lisa Nandy is soft left, nominated Jeremy Corbyn for leadership in 2015, I think I'm right in saying, but her kind of emphasis would be much more on, she represents a small town, kind of Wigan. You can expect a lot of kind of emphasis on that. You know, she made a big deal of being a Northern MP. She criticised the Marsh over the fact they'd wanted to come to London to do the interview. That's the kind of thing she is. I think that my hesitation about Lisa Nandy is she was one of the more absurd characters in the last Parliament in that she kept announcing that she was about to vote for a Brexit deal. If Theresa May only did X, Y, or Z, Theresa May would then do X, Y, or Z, and Lisa Nandy still wouldn't vote for it. Then you see Jess Phillips, who is obviously the people think is the great hope of the moderates. I would inject a note of caution here. I think Jess Phillips, the danger for her is it is very much about her. She is not short of ego, and I think that there are certain risks in someone becoming a candidate for leader who is so that. I keep thinking back to this moment when early on when she arrived in Parliament, everyone was rightly talking her up because she has a rare gift as a communicator. But she then went on Question Time, and this was after the whole, I don't remember if people remember this, whole incident in Cologne where there had been various sexual assaults on women on New Year's Eve, and it was clearly a kind of systemic problem. And she just declared that this is the kind of thing you see in Birmingham regularly on a Friday or a Saturday night, and that clearly lost her the audience and was not something that people thought was a sensible thing to say. So that'd be my note of caution about Jess Phillips. So she's undoubtedly the best communicator of all of them. Then there is Keir Starmer. I think he will run into a lot of opposition from Labour MPs sitting on small majorities in the remaining parts of the Red Wall, who will fear that having a kind of North London MP who basically was the person who got the Labour Party to shift to a second referendum position.
He did grow up on the Surrey-Sussex border, apparently, which is his important non-London backstory.
Get that on the leaflets.
And I think, if you think that Labour essentially has to wait for demographic change, for the fact that more and more people are going to university, so there are more and more graduates all the time, you know, he is your candidate for that scenario. So I think those are the four candidates. I think Jess Phillips is undoubtedly probably the candidate the Tories worry about the most. But I think she is also, for the reasons I said, a very high risk, high reward option.
And there's one other group that we haven't yet discussed, and those are the MPs who lost their seat, who will not be returning. Isabel, on Coffeehouse, you've written about, I suppose, what it is like or what they might likely be experiencing at this point. Can you shed some light?
Yeah, this is obviously not a piece saying that MPs have the hardest life and we should feel the most sorry for them out of everyone in the population. Oh, poor them. But it is worth thinking about what happens to MPs when they lose their seat. Often, for most of us, even sort of Westminster nerds, the last we see of them is in those sort of brutal lineups on election night where they're standing there trying to encase all of their emotions because they've lost, while their opponent, who they've spent the past six weeks fighting, is cheering and all their supporters are cheering. And you know, in some cases, when they give their speech conceding, they get booed by their opponents as well. So it's a horribly brutal way to lose your job. And, you know, anyone who has lost their job or has seen a parent lose their job knows that it's very traumatic anyway. But for that to happen in public and for then to there be a public fallout from that can have a real impact on MPs' emotional state. So, you know, they find it very difficult to, if they live in the constituency, they find it very difficult to get around the constituency because they feel that everyone is staring at them in the supermarket as the guy who lost, which, you know, has an impact. They lose their sense of identity, and identity is a really important thing in Westminster. MPs and advisers actually notice that when they say their job to other people, they sort of stand up a bit straighter and they respect them more. I mean, I know some MPs, and I'm sure we can all think of them, who find that there are more women who are attracted to them because they are MPs rather than their sort of status as a sex god. And suddenly all that disappears. The sort of the groupies disappear, the people who want you to sort things out for them, who actually sometimes might have been quite annoying, they disappear as well. And you have to work out what your new career is. And the strange thing is that all of us will have had these chats with MPs in the middle of a parliament when they're cross with their party leadership, largely because they haven't been promoted to their plum ministerial job they feel they deserve. And they'll say, you know, I could earn twice as much outside of here than I do here. And you sort of nod going, yes. But actually, that's not always true, because particularly if they haven't been promoted to a ministerial role, the MP on your CV does not actually have the boost that it used to anymore. And I spoke to when I was writing my book, Why We Get the Wrong Politicians, which is out now in paperback and hardback,
available on all good Amazon websites.
Yep, and others as well.
Ideal Christmas present.
Ideal Christmas present
for tying in with the Christmas
who hasn't
shopping
yet
theme from earlier.
But I interviewed a recruitment consultant called Max.
But don't get it for any newly elected MPs; they might not take kindly to Why We Get the Wrong.
They might need my next book, which is on depression, instead. Well, I interviewed this guy called Max Wiltshire, who's a recruitment consultant, and he had had a load of MPs come to him in 2015, particularly Scottish Labour MPs, because they were obviously wiped out in that election, who were ex-MPs, needed a job. And they were so confident that because they'd been MPs, they were going to swoosh into the sectors that he recruited for. And he said he was really shocked by how unskilled a lot of them were and how they'd actually spent the past 5 years doing jack all in Parliament. They'd sort of, you know, tabled a few early day motions and maybe asked a few questions here. And they thought that was going to get them, you know, a great job in aerospace or something like that. And he had to sit them down and say to them, well, you're not actually a very attractive candidate, which for anyone is quite hard to hear. But because of that sort of that strong identity you have as an MP with people looking up to you, you know, you go around the supermarket and people are like, oh, there's the MP and that sort of thing. That's a real shock to the system. And so it does take MPs a long time to find work. A lot of them end up as consultants, in inverted commas, which the Westminster joke is that that's basically unemployed. And you see some of them sort of floating around Portcullis House looking very sad. And there have been surveys of MPs who've said that it's taken them years to get over the shock of losing. Because if you're not prepared for that, then that is a big shock. And it's a massive upheaval to your family life. Now, obviously, MPs get a very comfortable payoff. It's double the statutory redundancy rate. You know, they do have more employment prospects than a steel worker in Redcar, for instance. And so this is not a, you know, why MPs have the hardest life and we should feel most sorry for them at Christmas. We should also feel very sorry for their staff. But it is worth pointing out that being an MP is not the big thing that it used to be anymore if you're trying to move on, than that if you listen to an MP in the next few years saying, I could earn twice as much out of here, you should probably just say to them, it's probably best to stay here, actually.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And if you're looking for another Christmas gift, say if you want to add something to Isabel's book, why not also buy your family members tickets to our event in the new year on what we can expect from a government now able to call the shots in Parliament? Join The Spectator for Coffee House Shots Live, The Boris Majority, with myself, James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson, as well as some special guests that are yet to be confirmed but will no doubt be brilliant. To book those tickets, you just need to go to www.spectator.co.uk/liveshots.